I'd like to welcome everybody tonight to another Ortho Insights, Ortho Evidence Insights World Tour in Canada. My name is Brad Petrosor. I'm an orthopedic surgeon at McMaster, but speaking on behalf of Ortho Evidence tonight. And I just wanted to remind you that this is a series of free, limited capacity online events. We have leading academics and surgeons from all over. We really want to encourage interactive and engaging discussions with you, the attendees, and with our faculty and surgeons, and listen to leaders and peers from around the world. We have just some housekeeping reminders that we are recording this event. During the presentation period, there's going to be, I'd ask people to mute and no video. And then during the discussion period, please feel free to unmute and to turn on your video so that we can see everybody and really encourage discussion. You can take part in the discussion in any way you want, raising your hand, unmuting, you know, one of these on the video and asking questions to the chat, etc. And then all of these recordings are going to be uploaded to the OE site for everybody to get as well. We have more Insights World Tour events coming up. Register for them separately. So tonight, I really have the privilege of introducing Lori Heemstra, who's an orthopedic surgeon and the director of research in Banff and the Sport Medicine Foundation, is an associate professor at the University of Calgary, and she is the second president-elect of the Canadian Orthopedic Association. And tonight is going to lead a discussion on addressing the gender gap in orthopedic outcomes research. And we're just so privileged to have you, Lori, tonight, and looking forward to the discussion.
Thanks, Brad. I'll just share my screen here. There we go. I think that should do it. Did I lose you guys? Can you see my screen or no?
No.
No, not yet. Not Sorry, no. Let me get it there. I might have been too quick. There we go. Anyway, thanks, Brad. It's really a pleasure to be part of the world tour this go around. And today I wanted to combine two topics that are really of great interest to me. So clinical outcomes research and gender diversity. I do have one disclosure though, and for this talk, I will use gender as a binary designation. And I do acknowledge that that is not inclusive. However, it is a short talk and really women are the majority of the minority. So, a gender gap in orthopedics, it actually sounds pretty obvious, and it probably is if we are talking about the number of female orthopedic surgeons, the pay gap in surgery, the number of women in leadership positions. But what if we take it one step further? Does the gender gap extend to our orthopedic patients? Does sex influence how we diagnose our patients? Does it influence how we make our decision to operate on our patients or to not operate on them? In how we research our outcomes? Is an orthopedic procedure or experience the same for male and female patients? As you can probably guess, the answer is there is evidence for a gender gap in orthopedic care. Let's talk about a subject that I spend a fair bit of time on, patellar instability. Women account for 75% of the patients that present with patellar instability. However, patellar instability was largely ignored as a condition worthy of surgical management until the last couple decades, and has only recently found widespread acceptance as a mainstream orthopedic topic. To set the stage, here's some quotes from some textbooks from the middle of last century. Here's Dr. Smiley in 1951. Patellar instability is overlooked, especially among women. Let me just advance. Are you letting people in, Abby? I'm gonna advance here. There, Dr. Houston, 1964. Patellar instability is almost never considered. Subluxation of the patella, predominantly in the female and absent in the athlete. Because really, those two conditions are mutually exclusive. Let's compare two knee instability scenarios then, patellar instability and ACL deficiency. Studies have consistently shown that patients with patellar instability are severely disabled, and in fact, have consistently shown that patients with patellar instability have lower quality of life scores than patients with an ACL tear. A study done in Norway showed that patients with patellar instability, and remember these are largely women, waited 2.5 times longer for surgery than patients with an ACL tear. This delay amounted for patients with patellar instability waiting 2.5 years before they're even offered surgery for their unstable knee, compared to 6 months with an ACL tear. Sorry, it's just not... I lost you. Sorry, I just lost my screen share. There we go. Let's talk about OA of the knee. We know that women have a slightly higher prevalence of OA of the knee at about 60%. So you'd probably expect that women would be offered a total knee arthroplasty about equal or a little bit more often than men. In a fascinating series of studies completed at the University of Toronto, James Wright and his colleagues showed that when anonymously presented male and female patients, so they presented with similar symptoms, similar complaints of knee OA, and similar x-rays, when they went to their family doctor, the family doctor was 2 times more likely to refer the male patient than the female patient to a surgeon for consideration of a total knee arthroplasty. That's fairly shocking. However, when those same patients, when the same patients went to see an orthopedic surgeon, and this is in Canada, the orthopedic surgeon was 22 times more likely to offer a TKA to the male patient than the female patient. I find this fairly distressing, 22 times more likely. However, when they sent a survey to both the family doc and the orthopedic surgeon, both of them thought that the patient's sex had no influence at all on their decision to refer or to recommend a TKA. So clearly female gender is a barrier to both the referral for surgery and the consent for surgery. Let's talk a little bit about research. Orthopedic clinical trials. There is a need for women to be included in randomized trials as well as in cohort studies. And gender-specific analysis of data is vital to understand our patient outcomes. Let me give you an example. Here's a study we published recently out of Banff, and we were looking at patient-reported outcomes after MPFL reconstruction in patients with patellar instability. So we thought we were pretty avant-garde, and we did an analysis based on sex. And we were pretty shocked to see that women actually did less well after MPFL surgery than men. This was fairly upsetting to me, since 75% of those patients were women. But an extremely important fact that we didn't account for initially was that the women had a higher incidence of pathoanatomic risk factors than the men did. And those risk factors were associated not only with their instability, but also with their outcome. So our initial statistical analysis was confounded by that. So we redid the analysis, taking into account the increased number of risk factors, and we found that sex actually did not play a role in outcome after MPFL reconstruction. Here's another study we just did recently related to the COVID closures. We looked at two groups of patients. One had their surgery delayed by the operating room closures, and the other group had their surgery in the 3 months prior to the closures, so both their follow-up and their rehabilitation was impacted. What we found was that women responded much differently to the questionnaire than men did. They reported increased symptoms, delayed recovery, the closures negatively affected their ability to work. They had increased frequency of anxiety, stress, concern, and frustration than men did. This is despite the fact that their EQ-5D3L, so that's a general health status outcome measure, showed no difference in scores between the male and female patients. So we need to consider that some of our patient-reported outcome measures that we currently use may have some gender bias, or alternatively, may not be sensitive enough to detect differences between our male and female patients. So, how can we begin to address this gender gap in the treatment of our orthopedic patients? Well, first, we have to recognize that a gap does exist. We need to identify both the overt or the conscious biases and the unconscious biases and how these manifest in the patient-physician communication. So female patients may communicate with their surgeons differently than male patients. This may include how they present their symptoms, both the quantity of their symptoms and the quality of their symptoms. There may be differences in pain responses between men and women. There may be a difference in the willingness or the ability of the patient to undergo surgery, and some of that may stem from the responsibility to be a caregiver to others. There also may be differences in what the patient is willing to or able to cope with. In addition, we should also consider there may be issues with how a physician interprets these symptoms. For example, a doctor may be more apt to attribute a female patient's symptoms to an emotional cause versus a physical cause. It's not a coincidence that the word hysterical is sometimes used for women being overly emotional. My kids have that operation game, and I am pretty sure that the knee joint is not connected to the uterus. Finally, however, we need to ensure that women are represented in orthopedic research. We need to make sure the data is analyzed appropriately and we take into account any bias. And that will provide us with the evidence we need to appropriately direct our clinical care. We need to improve diversity among healthcare providers. And this will be the key step to remove these biases and eliminate that gender gap we're seeing in our orthopedic clinical outcomes research. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So that's a very thought-provoking data that you're presenting. At this time, I think everybody can unmute or at least on video or video so that we can start to have a bit of a discussion. We've got a good solid 20 minutes. Does anyone want to lead off on what we just heard? And
Laurie, I would like to, as a hand surgeon, comment that we see quite similar problems in women, particularly older women who have had their distal radius fixed and present with ongoing pain, but the pain is dismissed, even though on closer history taking and examination, they actually have quite severe carpal tunnel. So a lot of it is unconscious bias and learning to understand that and not judge people, I think, is very important.
Yeah, that was a fantastic talk, Laura. I really appreciate you, sort of leading this discussion. And I think that it's an absolutely critical topic to discuss. I definitely am personally very passionate about this as well. And I think we see this a lot in the literature, and you gave a lot of really fantastic suggestions of what we can do to improve that. What would you say? I mean, a lot of us are involved with, you know, reviewing journal articles or reviewing abstracts or other things. Like, what would you, are there suggestions that you would make in terms of things that we could implement really kind of effective immediately to help stimulate this change?
Thanks, Mary. I think that probably the biggest thing for me was our age and sex study, because we actually thought, like, well, just analyze data for sex. I mean, that even was something new. Like, most of our studies are not analyzing data according to sex. But you can also fall into a little trap, which was what happened to us. We did that and thinking we were pretty smart. And then we actually found out that there are other things that can confound it. So I think number one is just making sure we have the numbers and we look at women as well as men. And we actually do that analysis separately, but also doing a little double check to make sure we're not confounding anything in between that. I think that's probably the first step. But I don't know, I was reading these studies and I just found those numbers pretty shocking. Like, I tried to pick Canadian studies because that's where I am. And like, you read those and like, that is shocking. Yeah. And I think just even realizing that this is going on and that we're not paying attention to it, it is really the biggest step.
There's a question from the group, from Naomi Bedeck. What's the ratio of male to female orthopedic surgeons in various countries, and does this affect surgery recommendations for female patients?
So you can read a really good article that was written about numbers of female orthopedic surgeons through the International Orthopedic Diversity Alliance, and some other numbers are coming up slowly. So you know, it varies between countries. In Canada, I can tell you we're 12% women orthopedic surgeons. I can also tell you that Ontario is the lowest of that number, and that study, which was actually done 10 years ago now or 15 years ago, was in Ontario. It would be really interesting to repeat that in somewhere that's higher numbers, like Quebec has very much better numbers of female orthopedic surgeons than other places. So that it varies, and I haven't seen studies of the answer to the other question because I'm not sure they've been done.
Yeah, I agree. There, in the United States, 6% of practicing orthopedic surgeons are women. And I haven't seen any studies done related to whether sex of the orthopedic surgeon influences recommending surgery.
Okay. Australia, less than 4.5%, Annette Holian says.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay, any other people want to ask some stuff? So where do these intrinsic biases lie? You mentioned some of them, Lori, in terms of, is it, you know, is the orthopedic surgeon not bringing out the right answer? Like, where do those intrinsic biases lie with respect to the patient relationship, and how do we get at that if some of them are unknown? How do we try and bring that stuff out? Because 22 great. Times more is just way too much. Like, it's huge, actually.
It's a great question, Brad, and I think the answer is both sides. I think, A, the female patients have to be clear in their symptoms. So how we women describe things is a lot different than men. Like, men walk in and say it, like, I can't do this, I can't work, and it's pissing me off, and I had it today. The guy goes, like, you have to fix me. This is not tolerable. I can tell you, I took my mother to an orthopedic surgeon in Toronto, and, you know, the woman can barely walk, and she walks in, oh, it's not too bad. Yeah, it bugs me once in a while. And it's like, so some of it is the patient. And so I don't know if women have been conditioned. My mother's the typical, was a stay-at-home mom, put up with things, don't complain about things, power through. And I think this is why a lot of patellar instability patients have not been fixed over the years, because they're not being specific. So I think some of the onus is on the patient, but I think a lot of the onus is on the provider. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can't make assumptions. And I think you have to realize that how men and women may describe something may be different, and you might have to turn your brain around a little bit when you're listening to a man versus a woman. So I think it comes from all these biases that have been inherent for hundreds of years, and they're ingrained in our culture. So I think the education has to go both ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other comments? Go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Hamstra, for the great talk. I was actually wondering, since we are now in the era of patient-targeted treatment and assessment, I was thinking maybe we should do a gender-specific validation of our assessment tool, like the scores, like the DASH score or the foot and ankle score. Do you think that's a valid point, actually, to think about?
It's an excellent point, and I tried to bring that up with that EQ, whatever it is. But the it's really interesting. I'm a sport medicine surgeon, so we use, even for example, the ACL quality of life score, which Nick Motati created in the late 80s. And, you know, it's a validated score. It's used. It's actually very useful. But there's a whole bunch of, there's questions on there about contact sports. And women just don't have access to and don't play many contact sports. So even a questionnaire like that, where there's several questions that may not be applicable to women, might alter your score. So again, you do these surgeries and we publish these outcomes of, oh, look, we shouldn't do ACL reconstructions in women because they don't do as well as men do. And that's why we offer it to men, and it can perpetrate the bias. So I think it's an excellent point that we need to look at our patient reported outcome measures and make sure they don't contain that bias.
And on that note,
Brad. I was just going to comment that we've just establishing our patient-related outcomes data is going to shortly be available. So we're hoping to be able to do some gender comparison there about, you know, what were our pre-op female and male scores versus our post-op, and did women come in with higher scores or lower scores, and just look at a comparison between the two, which should be quite interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a lot of work to be done.
Mm-hmm. Asks, would a gender training program for clinicians and surgeons address any gaps? And if you, I mean, we have training programs for everything. What if we were going to do that, what do you think it would look like? Do you think it's warranted? Number one, I think it would be. Number two, what do you think it might look like?
Well, obviously training and education, the answer is yes. What I don't think it looks like is the mandated health region, watch this video or you don't get your privileges. So I'm a research girl. I think you need to show the data. So, you know, you show studies like this and validate them and show them in different subspecialties, maybe not just arthroplasty, show them in sport medicine and hand, and show the data have the data be seen, that will help. Obviously training in unconscious bias training, but you know, taking the test is nice. It tells you something, but it doesn't change. So we need the data. We need to do the research so that we can show the world what's going on. I think most people, like if I was one of those surgeons of Ontario, I bet you they were horrified when they saw that data. Like I think a lot of it is unconscious. So education is key, but you can't educate unless you have data.
I think part two, one thing that we've talked about a little bit here in the United States with some of the American journals, and I'm a sports medicine surgeon too, is not limiting this to sports journals, but orthopedic journals in general, is even when manuscripts are submitted, having a little box that just makes people think, like, would sex-specific analysis be warranted for this study? Like, check, not check. And they think, oh, well, we had 500 patients, 250 were women, 250 were men. Instead of lumping all the results together, maybe we should look at them independently. So that's one thing that we've talked about here, which may, I mean, it's a start. That might help.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
So
mentoring more young women into research is really important as well, so that we have more researchers to look at these gender differences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just going off what you said, I'm 22 years old and I'm an honors student in Australia, and I just got introduced into research, and it's kind of crazy how this is just such an untouched area, and I'm myself looking at outcomes of total joint arthroplasty and prosthetic joint infection, and that's an area where men are actually really affected more than women. And it's surprising how in Australia, and I'm not sure what it's like around the world, that there's not that many policies that actually do encourage researchers to go down that route. Because I had no idea about sex disaggregated data when I was doing my studies before I entered my honours. So yeah, I think that's a really good idea, Jennifer.
So what do you think is the first study or the most pivotal thing to do initially? Lori, we have a group of people here, and Canadians, and everybody that's on the call here are all interested in collaborative work. What's the first thing that we should do, you think?
My feeling is the first thing we need to do is have good outcome measures, because we can do all the studies we want, but if our outcome measures are inappropriate or not specific enough, it doesn't matter if we study it to death, our answer is not going to be correct. So I think making sure our outcome measures are good enough is probably going to head us in the right way. And again, just starting to think about it. And I know, see, I can't pick one thing, Brad, that's impossible. But and increasing the number of female healthcare providers, right? So, mm-hmm. But that's going to go, you know, contribute to the gender pay gap too. So, so you know, it's one thing after the other, but I think raising awareness and then making sure our outcome measures are appropriate.
Yeah. And what do you think programs can inherently do to increase the numbers? You said, 12%, and our numbers are 6% and 4.5%. What do program directors need to specifically do to try and increase that? What level and who are the mentors? But anyway, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I think there's a fair bit of information on that, and some of it is just the cultural thing. So teaching people not to discourage women to enter specialties like orthopedics. So, and that's going to come right from when they're young. So it has to come right from encouraging girls to enter the sciences in university, enter med school. And then, you know, the statements you hear all the time, like, oh, you better not be a surgeon if you want a family, or you can't have, you know, children if you're a surgeon. Like those kind of statements need to stop. So I think as we improve gender equity throughout a girl's lifetime, these things will improve. Oh, Mary and Jenny, you can, there's been a fair bit of research on that kind of thing, but it's a long task.
One thing we're doing in Australia, Brad, is we are running workshops around the country in each state. It's been on a bit of a hold with COVID, but we're actually going out to medical schools and encouraging women to come to these workshops, where we have a combination of hands-on work on sore bones, and then a to and fro question answer session discussing issues for that are more specific to women. And our workshop is not just women. Our workshop is 50-50 male and female orthopedic surgeon facilitators. So it really provides a great environment where these women feel that they're not just being picked out by female orthopedic surgeons to be nurtured, but they're being welcomed by the men in the organization as well. And that's been quite positive. It's still too early to tell what effect it's going to have. We're several years behind. We're looking at, you know, first and second year medical students. They've still got quite a way to go, but it's been really positively received by medical students and junior doctors.
Yeah.
In the United States, and Brad, you may have heard of this already, but we have, Jenny, something that's very similar called the Perry Outreach Program, which started initially actually for high school students. So many of them, like in their sophomore or junior year of high school, some into their senior year. And it's set up very similarly. So hands-on activities, a little bit of didactics. One key difference, and I think it's a really interesting point that you raised, but one key difference is that the Perry Outreach Program tends to just have female faculty. So female faculty, female residents, and I think actually integrating with male faculty actually may be really advantageous, like you said. And there are some other excellent pipeline programs in the United States, Nth Dimensions being one of them. So I think just in general, the pipeline programs are really critical, because we have to expose students to this early, right? So high school, maybe even middle school. I mean, just giving them exposure so that they are even aware of this.
Yeah,
I agree. And sorry, Nick, go ahead.
So I was just going to say, we've got... we have a slightly different training system in Australia. The people might be a junior doctor for 5 or 6 years before they get into their advanced training for orthopaedic surgery. And that's the stage at which we're losing them. Our medical students are really positive about doing orthopaedics. And the program we're directing at, Jenny was referred to, as largely those junior doctors. But we've still only got 15%. We hope it'll rise, but we're sitting at about 15% of our applicants are women. And I think one of the big problems is about men seem to be very apprehensive about mentoring junior women. And I think it's one of the areas we're really going to have to work and make it a safe space in the way that men do that to encourage women to advance.
That's a great point. If I can call on Patel, what was that book you mentioned again?
Actually, there is a book talks about this. Actually, it's called Athena Rising. It discusses how men should mentor women in a male-dominant field. It's a very, it touches on all these important points in mentoring women. And I think this is a very, very important point, because to attract females to this specialty, I'm an orthopedic resident at McMaster at PGY3. I find it very difficult, especially back home. I'm from Kuwait. I find it difficult to find a mentor who can guide me until I get into residency. So I think that book is a good source for our mentors.
Yeah, it's a great book. And it is true, because there's not that many women orthopedic surgeons, and everybody wants mentors, but we get mentor fatigue too, right? So, you know, you start having to mentor every woman coming up into orthopedics, and the burden falls on just a few shoulders. And the reality is you don't have to be a woman to mentor a woman. All my mentors were men, and I had some excellent male mentors. So I think all these things are really good points, and all of them need to be done, and all of them need to be improved.
Yeah, I agree. As you mentioned, there is a problem with male-dominated fields, in that women often aren't deeply engaged in or embedded in the networks, because we don't go on the golf trips or we don't go on the fishing trips, and so we are not aware of opportunities that are out there, and we really need to create those networks. And there are a lot of great males who are very happy to support women and men equally. We just need to find different ways of networking together. So I would encourage young women to get involved in opportunities such as committees and places where people gather to discuss your profession, because those are where you'll have opportunities to find out what is happening at ground level and be aware of things that are going on that you might be able to link into.
Well, and on that note, sadly, it's just past 9, and these insights have been going for about a half an hour. So I think, Laurie, I'd give you the last word, and then we'll do a wrap up. So,
well, thanks, Fred. I didn't prepare a last word, but I want to thank everyone for joining. These topics are fascinating to me, and I have learned so much. And I've learned so much from some of the people who have joined us today, and I thank them, and I thank you all for contributing. I think the more we talk about these things, and the more it doesn't become a taboo topic, and we can just talk about it and work through it, things will improve and things will get better. And I guess the other thing with this whole topic is to speak out. We talk about being an upstander, not a bystander. So, you know, when you see things that don't seem right, is for people to speak up and not just let them go by. And I think, you know, things are improving, not quite fast enough for my liking, but they are improving, and they'll continue to improve.
Well, I just, I can't thank you enough for hosting this and for the discussion. And it's really made me reflect, and I think if we can all take away something, which I know we have, and make us all reflect, it's been a very important half an hour for me, for sure. And thank you so much for doing this, Laurie. Thank you so much for everybody who has joined tonight, and for your comments, and Mary and everybody else, and Batul and Annette, etc. Thank you all so much, and hoping that Ortho Evidence will hope that you join on some other ones this week. And again, really appreciate it. A great discussion. Thank you so much.